Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brook and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
Hi, I'm Debbie Brook, founder of Homeopathy World Community. I will be speaking with our regular co-host, Alan Phillips, attorney at law from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. He is one of the nation's leading vaccine rights attorneys. He advises individuals, families, other attorneys, groups, and organizations throughout the United States about vaccine exemptions and waivers. And he supports legislative initiatives aimed at expanding vaccine freedom of choice. He is well published internationally on vaccine health and legal matters and appears regularly at rallies, conferences, on many other radio shows, TV. He now is a regular author on Natural News with Mike Adams. He is a regularly featured guest on Freedomizer Radio and on a number of advisory boards. I welcome him wholeheartedly every Thursday as co-host for keeping us up to date on legal matters and teaching us what we didn't learn in the eighth grade, I guess. We also will be having Greg Glazer, who comes in on Thursday, the first Thursday of each month. By the way, this is Tuesday, so you don't, if you think that you've got the wrong day, we're doing it a little bit early today due to scheduling conflicts. But Greg Glazer, also an attorney at law, a constitutional lawyer from Copperopolis, California, is the founder of Civil Action Network, CAN. So like can do, let's do it, and an independent media organization offering coordinated citizens' referenda to promote justice, liberty, and sustainable living. You can visit his website at www.civilactionnetwork.org. And we will also give you some links in the show to download Alan's ebook, which is also a wonderful resource for anybody who's interested in these matters. I'm going to who's on the line with me today?
Hi, Debbie. This is Greg here.
Hi, Greg. I think Alan has either gotten hung up with a phone call or can't get to his computer right now. So it's you and me, and we'll be talking about some very important issues. This is part two of what we started last week with nanotechnology. And if you have any intro about you want to summarize what we talked about, and then we're going to move forward to the new questions at hand regarding vaccine rights and nanotechnology.
Sure, yeah. I'd be happy to give a little intro and recap. So
great.
In our last show, we talked about what nanotechnology is. And basically, nanotech deals with any structure that's smaller than 1 micrometer, which is less than 1/30th the width of a human hair. And we talked about how vaccines, modern vaccines, incorporate modern nanotechnology. We gave the example of squalene as one example, and other carbon nanotubule delivery vehicles for vaccines. And we talked a little bit about the statutory regulation of vaccines, or more specifically, the lack of regulation of nanotechnology. We also highlighted a loophole in the law that I found that allows the FDA to approve an unapproved nanotech delivery vehicle along once there is a declaration of an emergency by the secretary of the HHS, which is Kathleen Sebelius. And so today we'll talk a little bit more about the legal protections that are available to people with regard to nanotech. And unfortunately, I don't really have such great news in that area. There really isn't much legal protection. It's sort of after the fact, if you get harmed, type protection. The Constitution doesn't go... the Constitution allows a lot of remedies to people in terms of their rights, but they have to be proactive about them and convince the rest of society that these are legitimate concerns and rights to be protected. And unfortunately, it can take years to establish the scope of a particular right. And with regard to nanotech, there just isn't the authority out there right now to protect people from these hidden dangers, these hidden elements. But we'll talk a little bit about where there might be at least a theoretical basis to provide protection. And then, so that's the nanotech side. We were also talking a little bit about the federal and state powers and the role of policy and politics in interpreting these emergency regulations that might require vaccination in the event of emergency. And we talked about vaccine exemptions and then some loopholes that I found. The one loophole that we can cover today, let's cover the two main loopholes that I found. And
okay, and these are loopholes within the regulations. Where are we looking for these loopholes in ways that the government can get around not giving a person the ability to have an exemption or waiver, or is it a loophole that the individual can have so that they can get an exemption and a waiver?
It would be the former. Yeah, it's a
way
that the government gets to claim that vaccinations aren't mandatory, but then ultimately they make them mandatory through a loophole. And the first exception I found, or loophole that I found, is where if a parent decides that they don't want to get a vaccination, then they will submit their exemption form. So we're assuming there's an emergency here, and the parent says that they are submitting an exemption on the basis of religion or on the basis of medical exemption. And then they also submit an exemption on behalf of their child. But once you have a situation where you use an exemption, the government can issue its quarantine and isolation powers. So they could theoretically separate the child from the parent. And in that instance, then the state becomes the guardian over the child. And guess what the state's going to decide as the guardian? They're going to decide to vaccinate. So it's a little bit of a loophole that I found. It's just a risk. History shows us that the state cannot be trusted in that regard.
Well, what can I ask about that? If they separate and you are legally that child's guardian, and it's almost like I'm trying to think of like when you make a will and you want something to occur after your death, that is your right for those things to go to completion. And if you're alive and you make a statement that you want your children not to be vaccinated, then I don't see how the government can override that, because you're still alive. They could still call you and ask you. So even though they are supposedly in charge of them, they still need to get your consent.
Yes, yes. And we might look for analogy to cases of prisoners who are trying to assert their own parental rights from inside the jail. And what they find is that there's sort of at best a joint authority, because once the parent and child are separated, then the access to information is more limited. And so it's like there's two guardians. And the one guardian, in this case the state, would have the discretion and certain authority to exercise its healthcare judgment on behalf of the child. And in the event that the parent wished to challenge this particular judgment, first it would be difficult because it only takes 2 seconds to issue a vaccine, but it takes, you know, years to protect rights in court. And then in the event of an emergency, there's no guarantee that you would even have access to the courts, especially in the event of a martial law declaration, which is one of the topics we discuss in part one of our show, that you only get a military tribunal, and that's at best.
Mm-hmm.
And a military tribunal is a closed-door hearing where they, where the authorities get to hear the evidence, hear the arguments, and then make their determinations. And the state is acknowledges the right of exemption, but they also heavily favor the state interest in providing their own view of public safety, and that view of public safety is vaccination, inoculation, quarantine, isolation. We talked a lot about how the writing's on the wall. You know, when you look at the writings of state scientists and state lawyers, they are very much asserting these principles that the state has wide power. And I wrote a very detailed constitutional law analysis memo, which you can find at pandemicresponseproject.org. And my memo goes into detail as to why the state does not have absolute power over the human body. It can't make a person take a vaccination. And right very soon after I published this memo, the Congressional Research Service published their own paper, basically saying that the government does have the power of mandatory vaccination, but there are these philosophical, moral, religious, and healthcare exemptions for people, but it's, you know, limited by quarantine and isolation. And and that was a different conclusion than I came. It's a somewhat different conclusion than what I came to in my memo as to the power of the individual to quarantine themselves. The government saying that it's the government that quarantines, and I was saying that, well, the individual should have the right to self-quarantine. So there's a
Who's going to win that game? It's going to be, you know, that they have more power than you. So they're going to be the ones who are going to win out. Now, so it sounds to me like the only way to really change this game is for people to really speak out and stand up and say, we don't think that these vaccinations are even effective, and that we have to have a whole totally new perspective on what vaccinations can and can't do, especially in an emergency. Right? Don't you feel like that's going to be the solution to this problem?
I think that's spot on. The Constitution it depends on political activism in many respects. You know, the Constitution uses incredibly broad language in many cases, like the power to regulate commerce. And so the government will take those few words and just expand them and run with them unless the people keep the courts in check and keep Congress in check. And what we found is that over many years, the public has divested itself of an interest in the law. And the public is relying on the legal profession to, you know, carry the torch of keeping the system in check. And what I found is that the bulk of legal professionals out there just go along with the system and don't challenge the status quo. And that's particularly dangerous.
And they're obviously not educating themselves about these particular issues, because that takes a lot of work. They'll just accept the mainstream propaganda, I'll call it, the mainstream media, what they're being told about certain issues regarding health, without really doing some investigation about what the other side of the coin is talking about, whether something actually works or doesn't work.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's many, many levels of legal professional oversight. You have, you know, of course, your government lawyers, and then you have your private sector lawyers. And the private sector lawyers generally will go after things where there's a dollar behind it. You know, that's why you'll find a ton of asbestos lawsuits. And mm-hmm. But regulation on the government side is so much more challenging and thick. You know, it takes the Supreme Court can decide what cases it wants to take, and so Supreme Court kind of chooses how the whole debate is directed, and so it depends on the public as well to come in and say, you know, this is important to us. This is, we want change, and this this regard. And, you know, there's a lot of information out there that shows the dangers of what's happening today in the vaccination realm. You know, go to thinktwice.org and you can read all sorts of whistleblower reports from doctors and with published findings in medical journals showing the dangers of vaccines. And specifically with regard to nanotechnology, I'll just highlight one report. In 2009, the researchers at University of California, Los Angeles, the Johnson Cancer Center, they reported that titanium dioxide nanoparticles, and this is found in cosmetics and paint, vitamins, these nanoparticles cause DNA damage when fed to mice. You know, what it does is it induces a break in the DNA, so that damages the chromosome and causes inflammation of tissues and things like that. And that, of course, leads to a higher risk of cancer, which is what the study was related to in the first place. But the real essence of the story is that it causes damage to DNA, and that's just one particular type of nanoparticle. So we can expect this to continue occurring in the research field, that nanomolecules will continue to be developed that are, you know, you might use the word smart, that are smart nanoparticles because they trigger a specific gene. So, you know, there's many genes in the body, but not all of them are active. And so a nanomolecule released into the bloodstream or into the body will trigger this particular DNA molecule that will act a certain way. And one thing that is particularly prominent is when you want to trigger the immune system. It's called an adjuvant. And by releasing this particular molecule and triggering the immune system to overreact, it changes the structure and responses of the body. And this will, if you have a virus that was just released into you, like TB, then your immune system will overreact to the TB and will theoretically generate an immunity
right
to it. But overall, with the vaccine schedules that they have and with the toxins that are included in vaccines as a whole, the immune system just weakens. And so if you have a prolonged issuance of vaccines, your immune system breaks down. So, sure, you might get vaccinated against TB, and that's just, again, that's theoretical, but it makes you more susceptible to a host of other problems. And if you have a strong organic diet and, you know, good exercise and you know aren't a very stressed out person, you might be resilient. Your body's filters might be resilient toward that threat, that vaccine threat being presented to your body. But if you find yourself, and this is why I find the emergency situation to be so important today, that in an emergency, you're going to have disruptions to the food supply. You're going to have issues where people are very stressed out and aren't eating organic, aren't eating well. And to give them vaccines on top of that, that lend them their immune system, you'll find what you find in third world countries that get vaccines, mass health issues and problems and also death. And there's also conspiracy evidence behind this as well, like Leonard Horowitz found with AIDS and Africa and vaccines. Just look into it, and you might find that not all is what it seems.
Right. This is a very complicated issue, and overall, it sounds as if what has to be done legally, because, for instance, in the communications world and the federal communications bureau, whatever it is that takes care of that, they have to devise new legislation to deal with the new technology of cell phones and the internet and things like that. And in the same way, because the healthcare programs have been evolving and new technology like these incredible vaccine schedules that have been increasing and the development of genetic changes to, you know, targeting the genes of human beings to supposedly keep them healthy or prevent them from getting sick, means that maybe the law, the legal aspect of the government needs to find a way to adapt to these changes, this nanotechnology. We've never had it before. So how do we deal with it? And who is going to take the responsibility for changing, which we keep going back to, the people are going to have to speak up or shut up, I guess. You want to answer those questions?
Yeah, sure.
Questions?
Yeah, I would add that there's multiple layers of law enforcement on nanotech, but in the big picture, they're focused just on collecting risk data right now. Like the EPA issued a rule in May of this year, which is under the Toxic Substances Control Act, the TSCA, which says that, you know, they're going to monitor risk data. And whenever a manufacturer has a new nanotech product that they want to put out, then they have to give the EPA notice that this is what that they're manufacturing it or processing it. And then the EPA will issue a determination whether it's hazardous to human health. And once that determination is made, then the EPA evaluates the intended use, and then they, if necessary, will prohibit or limit the activity before it occurs. But there's no precedent for this. You know, again, this is just a rule passed in May of this year. And so we don't know exactly how they are going to limit nanotech. It may be that they just have another disclosure rule. You know, when you go get a drug over the counter, you know, then you have that long list of side effects. It may be that they have to include something like DNA damage in there.
Right, who's going to go and read that? And the truth of the matter is they're playing around with these nanotechnologies that the effects could be decades from now. You know, once you use this product, who knows how it makes these genetic changes or something gets hidden in the body, and then there's a flip switched, you know, like a switch flipped, excuse me, you know, like going through, let's say you're at the airport and you have to go through these scans now. How do we know the relationship between the changes that these nanosubstances are going to make, and then you get hit with some radiation and something happens? Nobody really knows.
Yeah. You know, the most effective weapons are the time-release weapons, and fertility is the ultimate in time-release targets because, just like we saw with the Terminator seed, you know, read that book, Seeds of Destruction by F. William Engdahl, where he goes into talking about, you know, that seed developed by Monsanto, which couldn't reproduce?
Yes.
It terminated by itself. It used to be that Monsanto they'd give their seeds to farmers, and they'd make the farmers sign contracts that said they wouldn't reuse the seed and get a new contract the next year to buy more seeds.
Right.
Well, then Monsanto developed this new seed. They genetically engineered it, which terminates itself, so it won't reproduce. Now they don't need the contracts to farmers. So in the same way, we've been finding similar evidence with regard to nanomolecules and DNA damage. It's this idea that if you give a particular structure of nanomolecule to the mice, then the mice won't be able to reproduce, like just what they did with genetically modified foods. And it doesn't it affects the second generation far more than it affects the first generation, rather than the source generation. So it's this release thing.
If it does affect the second generation, not only will it be many, many years in advance, maybe 20 years or 40 years, the correlation is going to come really too late for these families, which will then end their line because they're not going to be able to reproduce or have kids. So we have to look into the future somehow and make these judgments upon information that we don't really have.
Yeah, and I suspect that a lot of what we're talking about is it almost doesn't matter because the damage is already done. You know, like look at it matters in the sense that, you know, these issues need to be brought up, but I think what we're looking at is there are covert military programs to spray the populace with dangerous substances. Like look at chemtrails. You know, it's those trails in the sky filled with toxic substances like barium and aluminum. Well, others have proposed that there's also nanomolecules that are being dropped onto the public that cause causes DNA interference. And so if they're already dropping barium and aluminum, and that can be tested, you know, what would stop them from dropping things like Morgulons? You know, and I just I don't know.
Well, what can a person do? I mean, they're just doing their daily routine, and these things are happening all around in their environment. They have no control over these kinds of things. And you're telling us that we need to boost up our immune system by eating well, but these chemtrails and whatnot, I mean, we're kind of going off the topic of we're staying on nanotechnology here, because these particles can come down and they drop to the earth and they go in the plants and we eat the plants and the animals who graze on the grasses. I mean, it's all in the ecosystem now. It's all circulating, so there's no way of getting away from it.
Yeah, right. You know, I think that a healthy immune system, though, will help a great deal, because it's hard to destroy DNA. Like you can mutate it, but it may be that there is a way to restore it. So I don't know, but I think that the issue we're delving into is an issue of what's commonly called transhumanism, where it's feared that the powers that be, like dark powers behind the scenes, have an ultimate goal of developing technologies that will allow them to not be harmed by the same substances that they are using as military weapons against the populace to reduce the population. So it's a very tricky field of conspiracy evidence research, but
I don't think that they can. That's my own personal belief. I mean, if it is prevalent, if it is everywhere, I don't think that they have anything, an antitoxin, kind of thing. I don't think that they do. And they're playing with something that they really don't know the outcome and the harm. Just, Rachel Carson, she was the first, and she told us that we're ruining our environment. So let's go back to the legalities of here. Did we cover express statutory regulation and the right of privacy and the right to bodily integrity? Did we cover that already?
Next. We did touch on some express statutory regulation of nanotech. Talked about that EPA rule, and in our Part 1 show, we talked about the California Department of Toxic Substances Control, how they're the most active agency in the regulation of nanomaterials, and they're also gathering data. And you have two levels of protection. You have your state authority and your federal authority. And in the event that we can get a government in there which is willing to actually stop these military technologies from being used on the public, hey, imagine that.
Mm-hmm.
We might be able to make some ground. I mean, the institutions are in place to protect the public. They're just misused. So that's express statutory regulation. In terms of what a person can do themselves, where you don't need the government to protect you, there's lots of common law rules and tort rules that if there was some type of legal action, you could theoretically win a case against the government and force them to stop bombarding the public with these dangerous materials. But the odds of winning that case are just go figure. So, and one of those. One of those rules would be the right to bodily privacy. This is a fundamental right under the Constitution. It comes from the right of privacy, and it's the right of bodily integrity. And look at the case of Cruzan versus Missouri. And it's this idea that you have a right to choices about your body and the right to be free from interference, unreasonable interference into your natural body. And it
and
relates...
The outcome of that particular Cruzan versus Missouri, what was that again?
Yeah, in Cruzan involved a patient in a hospital, and they were refusing medical treatment. And the court said, of course you can refuse medical treatment. It's your body. And it was a state action because she was at a state hospital. It was the Missouri Department of Health. And it set a helpful precedent for the right to refuse medical treatment, and that's how the government proposes these measures as your vaccine is a medical treatment. So now chemtrails would be in a whole different league. That would be analyzed under, I think the rationale for spraying metals on the populace is to combat global warming, which is just bogus. And the government hasn't yet come out and admitted it, but at the international level, they've already requested the authority to do it. So, again, if you just kind of look behind the scenes, you can see that it's...
So requested the authority to do what, please?
Yeah, the at the international level, there's been great discussion about, and this is scientific discussion, open in the public record, where officials are discussing the benefits of spraying metals into the atmosphere to combat global warming. And
okay.
Those metals are things like aluminum, because it reflects radiation. And, you know, you spray aluminum, it falls to the ground within, you know, 6 to 12 hours. But it temporarily will relieve, you know, will cause a sort of a reverse greenhouse effect, because it... it will float in the atmosphere, deflecting radiation from the sun back into the upper atmosphere. Now, once that aluminum falls to the ground, then it enters into the soil and into the water supply, which causes a higher pH, a higher acidity. And that makes it difficult to grow organic food.
There's more to aluminum, because it goes into the brain and it causes Alzheimer's.
That's right. Yeah, exactly.
We have a very high level of that incidence right now, and the medical community has nothing to deal with Alzheimer's.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's certain foods you can eat that will help remove heavy metals from your body, like cilantro.
Right, right, right. But that's a whole process in itself.
So
it falls into the water supply, and it causes a higher acidity, and then it is more difficult to grow organic foods because the pH has changed?
Yeah, you know, a lot of the foods in the common diet, you know, your corn, tomatoes, wheat, they require a pretty balanced pH. And when you raise the acidity of the soil, then it becomes necessary, well, not necessary, but it becomes more important, if you want to have high yields, to apply basically
lime.
Preps and, you know, things that will lower the pH of the soil, like lime. And
to balance it.
It's pretty expensive, you know, especially if you have a you know, an emergency where, you know, access to materials becomes difficult. So, yeah, it's a perpetuating cycle. And, oh, guess who asked for a patent for aluminum-resistant seeds?
Couldn't have been Monsanto.
No, it couldn't have been Monsanto, right? I mean, again, the writing is on the wall. If you find this information, you start to connect the dots, and it doesn't even have, like, it's not even difficult to find the information. Just pick up a book, go to globalresearch.ca, and pick up a book over there, read some articles about it. This information is out there, and independent researchers are just pulling their hair out, thinking, "Gosh, how does the public not see this?" And
well,
almost,
are we hearing it on the nightly news?
At best, you might be able to piece some of it together. I mean, I think there's a huge resistance to companies like Monsanto, but their propaganda is so strong. You know, they present themselves as this company that is helping to feed the world. And if you take away Monsanto, you know, you take away, you know, food prices go up, and the infrastructure of international food trade just fundamentally changes. And, you know, they're so big and strong, you know, companies like Monsanto, Cargill, Bayer, AG Sciences, and so integrated that, just like how the public bailed out the banks, you know, they'll do it again.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's this fear of change, of taking. I mean, it's interesting because, you know, we're presented with a very radical and dangerous world, and yet we won't take very radical and proactive steps to change it. But I'm attempting through. I have this organization, CAN, which you had mentioned in our introduction, where I proposed referenda that would try to unseat this military-industrial complex. But.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm just out there trying to talk about some things. But, you know, but so are so many other researchers, and there hasn't been a material change in the system this whole time. It's always the military-industrial complex. It keeps growing, and science and technology are so obscure and integrated into this military technology, into this military-industrial complex that.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've invested an awful lot of financial input in the United States into the military and into the war. And to pull out of that would be a very difficult thing because probably people think that sustains the economy. You want to go ahead with the crime of battery?
Yeah. So the crime of battery relates very much to the right to bodily integrity, that fundamental constitutional right you have to refuse medical treatment. In the same way, the common law right to be free from someone harming you, someone battering you, it goes hand in hand with that fundamental right, and it's independent of the United States Constitution or the California Constitution. You have a right to bring legal action against any person or corporation who commits a battery against you, which is an unreasonable intrusion into your person, into your body. And mm-hmm. a battery can be a small nanomaterial as well. It doesn't have to be a fist to the face. It can be a needle in the arm. It can mm-hmm. be when spraying something onto your land. Although that also relates to the tort of nuisance, where you have a tort loss, and a tort is like a civil action for money, where a person sues another person or a corporation by submitting a claim or a complaint in superior court or in a federal court, which states that this actor, you know, this defendant, put a particular element into the atmosphere with the intent that it land and with the knowledge that it would land on, you know, the plaintiff's property, and it caused harm. You have to document the harm, so you need an expert, and then you have to.
This sounds really interesting. Yesterday's show, I had Heidi Stevenson on, and we discussed Monsanto and saving one of the organic seed companies, because if they don't have funding to get their loan and pay, they tried to change the law for them, and if they don't pay up front for their loan, then this organic seed company that started, I don't know how many years ago, they were in the in our history. I'm trying to think of the Clark. I don't have it at the tip of my tongue, but they need our help because Monsanto is just going to go ahead with the polluting or contaminating the organic seeds. And is this not reflected here in this type of battery, because their stuff is moving over into the organic land? They're going over the boundaries. How come the organic farmers can't defend themselves against that, and instead Monsanto is doing claims against the organic farmers?
Well, Monsanto found a loophole, a bias loophole, and it's a patent law, which says that a person infringes on a patent, any infringement on a patent is a strict liability. Is governed by principles of strict liability. So it doesn't matter whether you intended to infringe on someone's patent, or whether you knew that you were infringing on someone's patent, or whether you're at fault for infringing someone's patent. The way the rule is that if you find yourself infringing on someone's patent, then you are strictly liable for the violation, and you have to pay damages accordingly. So this rule is being challenged by the Organic Consumers Association and other organizations. I think cornucopia.org, which is an amazing website, by the way. It's an amicus brief. So, you know, it's just one of those things where, you know, Monsanto capitalizes on their particular knowledge of the law and their resources to, put small farmers in their place. And, you know, there's many examples in history where you don't have to be ultimately right in order to win. And Monsanto is not ultimately right, but they're winning. And what's a good example? Like a you know those supposedly eco-friendly light bulbs?
Yes, it has mercury in them.
That's got mercury in it. Okay? It's toxic. Yeah. It's terrible. The previous light bulbs were far more eco-friendly. You know, but California passes this law which says that by, I think it's like 2014 or something like that, every household has to use these new energy saver bulbs. And probably the law will get overturned, you know, but in the meantime, they're all over stores, they're super cheap, you know, you get rebates from the California government. And so whether the law gets changed or not, it doesn't matter, you know. The industry already won. They already got their toxic substance into everybody's house. And so all they needed was just to, you know, get the ball rolling well enough and to cause all the damage. And so that's why I say, you know, the damage is already done. The chemtrails have been sprayed for decades.
Each of these things we really never find out before the fact, before they get interspersed into the environment or into every household and cause environmental toxicity indoors, not just outdoors, because everybody thinks and knows and believes that these super saver light bulbs are going to save you energy and put out more light. But how the harm is what? If the light bulb then has to be, it's toxic waste and has to be disposed of properly and not put in the regular trash.
It also emits a mercury wavelength where the mercury releases from the bulb when it's in use. I mean, just look at the studies of people who have to work under mercury bulbs for 8 hours a day. You find some very sad and depressed and stressed out individuals. Mercury is a neurotoxin. It's one of the most dangerous neurotoxins there is. And if you break that bulb, and most people don't know this, if you break one of those bulbs, that's toxic waste. You know, you should be wearing gloves and a respirator and not enter the area for, I think it's like a day. You know, to put one of those in every house, it just sounds insane to me, but there you go.
But the problem is that we don't know about it until after the fact.
I mean, like we talked about in our part one episode, you know, this is your classic DDT, your Agent Orange, your asbestos. But now the stakes are higher because the intrusion, the infiltration is on a worldwide basis. And, you know, like chemtrails are sprayed in NATO countries, you know, so it's beyond just the United States of America. And these vaccines are being implemented all over the world. And these light bulbs, again, are going in all over the world. And
they're not going to be produced. They're putting the other people out of business, the older types of filament bulb. So this is one of the things that happens with monopolies and big business. It puts the little guy who produces the older technology out of business.
Yeah, you know, you'd almost need a coordinated worldwide referenda approach for the citizens to take back power and say, we're going to divest our governments of authority to implement these particularly harmful measures. And, has anyone proposed that? Has it been, are any efforts underway to do that sort of thing? I mean, I think what we find is that there are worldwide coordinated efforts to make change. You know, WikiLeaks might be an example of that. But currently the United Nations is corrupt and beholden to the major Axis powers. The United Nations is a military arm of the major governments in power, and those major governments in power are run by individuals behind the scenes, as Supreme Court Justice Frankfurter said.
I wanted to interject here about the seed company. It's called Landreth, Landreth, and they are in need of support and help. What happened was they have created many of the old-time original seeds, and they went to the Lewis and Clark expedition, and they helped to promote the use of the Osage orange as a windbreak in hedgerows. And the Landreth Seed Company helped to support Commodore Perry expedition to Japan by preparing thousands of pounds of seeds for their trip. I mean, they have a historical basis in our country, and yet they're going to be put out of business because of these GMOs.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to check out yesterday's Monday show and find out a little bit more about that. So we have a little bit of time left if you want to continue on.
Yeah, what topic should we talk about next?
Okay, next on the list here is the precautionary principle that we apply here, and is it relevant? How much risk should society allow with respect to structures that interact at the DNA level? And this is something we touched upon earlier, the fact that how destructive these types of nanoparticles can be to the DNA itself.
Yeah, the precautionary principle can accomplish wonders. It is this doctrine, and it's a theory, which says that governments should be proactive in prohibiting environmental threats so that, just like under the Napoleonic Code, something is prohibited unless Napoleon allows it. Now, that's obviously very dangerous because we are living in a world that's governed by many little Napoleons. So why would we give the military-industrial complex the authority to regulate itself, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, we have.
Yeah, right, we have. So the precautionary principle, in theory, would apply. I mean, would work great if we had benevolent rulers who would take the principle and prohibit these harmful substances from ever entering the economy, from ever entering military weapons. But is it relevant where you have a situation where the economy, we have a fascist state, with companies like Monsanto's, like Cargill, Bayer AG Sciences, and then what risk should society allow with respect to these structures that interact at the DNA level? And I think our common sense is telling us that we should apply this precautionary principle. And if we had a intelligent or smart scientific review, we might be able to accomplish that. But for those who follow the global warming debate at the international level, we can see that the scientific findings are routinely manipulated to accomplish a particular political
Okay. Yeah. I want to introduce that Alan is with us now. He just was able to get on the line, and so Alan, we are just talking about the precautionary principle, that it's a theory that the government should be proactive in taking care of these environmental threats, and we're talking about nanotechnology today. And who is in charge? Greg is telling us all about these little individual czars, the Napoleons, who are governing themselves, and that we should have some kind of intelligent or smart scientific review. And as my response to that, I keep thinking, well, we have all of these drugs that are being pushed to market, so we're not really taking care of that precautionary approach when it comes to drugs. Why would we do that with nanotechnology itself?
Well, there's a website that I saw recently that reports that something on the order of 80% of federal government employees are not elected, they're appointed, and this happens a lot in the federal agencies. And so getting transparency, having any control over the objectivity of the people who are in these positions and making decisions is a very difficult thing to do, and lends itself, I would assert, just on the basis of my general research into vaccines and to some extent beyond that into the larger healthcare arena, that and in and out of healthcare, frankly, there's some convincing evidence that a lot of federal agency policy is driven by something other than an objective review of the scientific information and the best interests of the constituents of citizens. So it's a very difficult subject just right there from that layer or aspect of it.
Yeah. It's also a two-headed or a double-edged sword, or two-headed monster, if you like. Probably come up with other examples. because we don't want the government to be too proactive, because when they are proactive, they tend to strip away our rights, like with this example of vaccines. You know, they're going so far to protect the public health that they'll try to force a dangerous vaccine on you. And then in the process of sticking this needle of toxic substances in your arm, you know, they'll ask you to say thank you for saving you, right?
Well, you just did a perfect segue into something that I did want to mention today, and that is this news. They're asking, it's on the NVIC, to help stop coerced vaccination of children behind their backs, the backs of their parents, which actually connects perfectly with how you started the show about when there's a quarantine and the parent and the child are separated. It is hard to believe this, but the California legislature has done the unthinkable. They passed this into law, the AB 499, which permits the minor children as young as 12 years old to be vaccinated with the sexually transmitted disease vaccines, I imagine that must be Gardasil, without the parental knowledge or parental consent. And correct me if I'm wrong with this, Alan, you're probably up on this news, and they're asking on these websites to stop the erosion of the rights of parents to be control over their the vaccine risks that their children will take. And this is this old news or is this current news to ask Governor Brown to veto AB 499?
Well, this particular bill has been on the table for a few months, and I would love Greg's input and feedback. I wrote an article about this bill and law here in North Carolina. I personally feel that it is unconstitutional, which there are sort of two different aspects to this. One, the fact that a state legislature can enact a law that is unconstitutional, and the difficulty there has to do with the fact that it's the courts and not legislatures that ultimately decide that. In other words, it's not unconstitutional just because I think it is. What that really means is that I think that if this were challenged in court on a constitutional argument, that the greater likelihood is that the court would say, yes, this law is unconstitutional. Although if it were challenged and lost on that count, I would be even more concerned than I am right now just with what the legislature has done. But the bottom line is state legislatures can enact anything they get the votes for, whether it's something that would hold up to a future scrutiny of a court. But in brief, any time a state takes authority from a parent and gives it to any other person or party, and in this case they're taking a parental decision and giving it to a minor child, they are in effect saying that for purposes of that decision, the parent is unfit. And we have a due process, 14th Amendment due process right to parent our children. We are deemed under the 14th Amendment to be fit to make decisions for our children unless there's a showing of unfitness. In other words, until a court sees evidence and says, you are unfit parent, we are legally fit. And so I feel like this giving authority to anyone with the exception of emergencies, and I think we would all generally agree, or most of us, that the medical authorities already have authority to intervene in a medical emergency to save a child's life or to prevent serious harm without asking the parents' permission first. And we hope they have that authority and that they'll exercise it well when it's needed. But you're talking about routine immunizations here. There's no present emergency. And so, therefore, I feel like it's just a blatant usurpation of parental rights.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you have your due process emancipated minor proceeding, which is supposed to balance the parent's rights with the minor's rights. And so I think that you would find that for an automatic exemption for children the age of 12 would be not balanced, but an affirmative declaration by the legislature that usurps the parental power. So, yeah.
I'm confused how they can even make this proposition. How can they make it a bill? How can they put it into law when it, from the outset, from the, you know, the get-go, there's something that is not right with it?
I think the rationale in favor of these laws is that there are some parents who aren't stepping up to the plate and doing the proper and correct thing for their children's health. But we already have systems in place to deal with that. If there's a serious abuse and neglect, the state can step in and remove the children from the home. If there's a challenge to on a lesser level to the fitness of a parent, you know, courts can look at that. And if there's a problem, the courts can give custody to someone else or give decision-making authority to either another parent or a relative or, you know, whatever the law allows. But there's always provisions for giving custody to someone, including the state if necessary, so that there is a fit parent or guardian in place. But to presume that all parents are unfit, and that's what I think you're doing when you enact legislation allowing children to consent to non-emergency medical care is really going too far. But there may not have been people making the convincing arguments to the legislators at the correct time to raise these other issues. I mean, if you don't have the arguments in front of the people voting, or if you do and you're not convincing, then, of course, you risk losing the vote here. So,
no, you know, it's interesting. What just occurred to me is that it's actually state law that sets the age of a minor. And so when the state then comes in and sets a new law that says that the age of consent for this particular decision is 12, then how is that not within the state's authority? Because it is traditionally within their authority to set the age for a minor. You might have to look a little bit deeper to see if there is a more fundamental right. So, yeah, actually, before jumping to any conclusions on the constitutionality of that, I might have to do a little bit more research.
Like it really complicates the law if there's already provisions set to take care of these types of situations between parents and children, whether they're being taken care of properly, to complicate it and put in something that is so specific in this area.
Well, there's another argument here, Greg, and your point is a really good one, a well-taken one. And my first thought is, well, can you decide, you know, what's legal age for one issue that is not consistent with legal age for other issues? And so that's an interesting sub-point. But aside from that issue altogether, at this point, it's the child's religion is deemed for legal purposes to be that of the parents, and parents in most states have the right to a religious exemption to immunizations. And so when you give that decision to a child, you risk usurping the parents' First Amendment free exercise of religion right, as well as the state law religious exemption right. And so to me it seems that there's a conflict there as well, so that without even resolving the question that you brought up, although I think that's a good one worth looking at further, I think there still is a conflict with the religious exemption statute for any state that clearly has a religious exemption option for the parents. You'd have to read in an implication that the children get to decide what their religion is as well.
I was just about to say that. It seems pretty unfair that one would be deemed to have the religion of, you know, just imagine if your parents were Satanists.
Well,
yeah.
You know what?
Well, obviously, the only religious right that's going to hold up is one that's valid under law. But
you know, this isn't too far fetched, because recently in the news, you'll hear it on the radio and read it in the newspaper, the UK officials threatened to take 4 obese kids away from their parents after they failed to lose weight. So they're trying to create this law where obese children can be taken away from the custody of their parents. And if that's coming from, you know, we're colonialists from Britain, what does that say about the way governments are thinking about health and people's rights and family rights?
Well, to me, it's just a specific version of already existing abuse and neglect laws. You know, is there a point at which a child's obesity becomes a form of abuse or neglect on the part of the parent? And I think that's a legitimate question, but I also think there's a risk of jumping to conclusion without looking at some of the broader issues. Why are children obese? Certainly there is a component to the answer that includes parenting, but we also live in a society that massively markets non-nutritional foods directly to children and of course, to parents. And we also live in a society where many times low-income parents can only afford food that is basically not very nutritional. Sometimes the more nutritious food is more expensive. And so I think it's more complicated than just kind of the superficial question of can we just, you know, call a parent a bad parent because their child's obese. Should the parent perhaps receive some counseling and the child as well?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe. But with all the non-nutritious food, I can understand why children and adults alike in some instances are consuming food to the point of full or past full, but they're still hungry because they haven't actually gotten any nutrition or very little. And so
right.
Their body,
so
they're still hungry.
Right. So instead of taking the children away, you have to do some educational programs for families and provide for families so that they can give their children what they need to subsist on nutritional foods and sunshine and exercise and do all the things that are right, rather than simply removing them from their caretaker.
Well, I don't think that's the role of the government to advise parents how to raise their kids. I think that it's the role of the media.
The role of the media?
Yeah.
To provide information, you mean? Or?
I mean, I guess if you wanted to take a very broad view of the police power, I'll quote the Supreme Court, police power is that inherent necessary power essential to the very existence of civil society and the safeguard of the inhabitants of the state against disorder, disease, poverty, and crime. You know, so it's this idea that, you know, the police power is sort of general, like what can the state do, you know, to protect people from disease and poverty and crime and protect their health, and mm-hmm. educating them, you know, putting out little fact sheets on, you know, here's a dietary.
Well, I mean more than just fact sheets. I mean, don't we send our children to school? I mean, don't they have a right to be educated properly? Don't they have a right to have a good nutrition when they go to school? I mean, this is much broader.
On a right to public education for up to the age of, there's a right to public education. And when in school, they will give you food, and they have programs in place, you know, to gauge the nutritional value of that. But, you know, again, this is a government that doesn't serve organic, natural foods that probably has, you know, they tend to irradiate foods. Now, this is mm-hmm. this is decision making at the, it's partly scientific in the sense that, like, they're really trying to avoid risk. They would rather, you know, irradiate. They would rather knock out the nutritional content of food for millions of children rather than have, you know, two kids get sick from one particular bug that happens to be on an apple. But then mm-hmm. by knocking out the nutritional content of food, it lowers the immune support, and then, you know, hundreds of kids get sick. So,
but Greg, there are two questions that come to mind to me here as I'm listening to this, and one is, how efficient historically has the government been, or how efficient can it be even hypothetically, in assessing objectively, you know, and implementing scientific analysis of what's best and how do they do that, you know, and to what extent is or can or should that be the role of government accordingly, versus, and, you know, and how, and as a practical matter, is that something that's influenced by industry and skewed by the influence of industry seeking to serve itself? You know, I suspect the reason that milk is a required component of school lunches is not because children are healthiest if they drink milk every day, especially when it's been changed through pasteurization and other processes. but rather because the dairy industry has lobbied for and created and or compiled and put together information supporting its best interests. And I'm not saying no one should ever drink milk, but I just use it as an example. You know, I wonder, I mean, do you have thoughts about that and the implications as to whether or not and to what extent government should get into these kinds of analyses?
Yeah, the Constitution doesn't specifically state, the federal Constitution doesn't specifically state what, it goes into the enumerated powers, but then those enumerated powers, you know, like to regulate commerce, regulate interstate commerce, you know, manage ports, lay and collect taxes. Then those powers have been broadened, and then the state has all these traditional powers. And so, you know, these things get discussed in the courts, but, you know, this is just the general idea of protecting the public safety. It's come into a realm where if the state does take up the responsibility to provide public education, then they will go to great lengths to, you know, include nutrition in that as well. And so that would be a, you know, and as long as you accept the right that the state has, I mean, the idea that the state has the right to provide a public education, then you would naturally agree that they have to somehow figure out what to do about food for the students there. So, and then as for the public in general, why they issue these little, you know, fact sheets and nutrition pyramids, because that's what people want. Doesn't mean that there's necessarily the legal authority to do it. I think that generally personal responsibility is a far better approach. When people think that the government has the answers, they tend to not analyze it for their own life and not take personal responsibility, and that makes them more susceptible to risk. You might even, it's kind of funny actually, I just drew the analogy to vaccines. It's just like that, you know, you lower your immune system and bam, it makes you more susceptible to risk.
Right. I wanted you to bring this around, this whole discussion about taking care of families and family rights and states and federal rights to govern in different parts of the person's life, the individual's life, and how this relates to what we've been discussing about nanotechnology and the authority of government over the people.
Yeah.
So, go ahead.
Yeah, well, you know, for minors, it follows from the doctrine of in loco parentis, you know, that old one, you know, where the state becomes the parent when you give, when the minor and or the parent gives consent. So once you put your kids in public school, then you're granting a certain consent to the order and public health measures of the school. And so that's why there's, you know, it's easier to search a kid's backpack at school than it is off school grounds. So if you conduct your life, though, in a traditional sense where, you know, you don't go to public school and you try to not go into these public forums and interact with government as much, then, you know, you'll see that you have much much greater rights. Government more.
Oh, my goodness. That's an interesting way to think about it. Just stay clear of going to a place where you could have your rights interrupted by the government. So do we want to conclude today's show and pick up again at another time, or do you want to talk for another few minutes? It's up to you.
Sure. I'll close with one, with just a closing comment of a funny thing I found today.
Okay.
I was watching the government's authority for isolation and quarantine in the event of a declared emergency for a health issue. And I found what's called a fact sheet on legal authorities for isolation and quarantine. And this is from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. So this is, your federal government has a fact sheet for isolation and quarantine. And it's a fact sheet on legal authorities. And in this fact sheet, they don't list a single legal authority. So that should tell you that the government is doing what it wants to do, what it wants to accomplish. They make their own summaries, their own FAQ sheets. So it's important to be proactive to protect your individual rights, because you can't expect the government to protect them for you.
They made a fact sheet. They made a fact sheet. The CDC made a fact sheet about the authority of government during a situation of isolation and quarantine, And that was supposed to list, you're saying, who has the authority to take control or implement certain things, and they didn't list an authority to do any of those things?
Yeah, yeah. It's like a little two-page document. It says, you know, fact sheet of legal authorities for isolation and quarantine, but there's no legal authority even cited. It's just a bunch of statements about, oh, well, we have the power to do this, and we have the power to do that.
Let me just clarify that when Greg says legal authority, I believe he means there's no reference to statutes or legal precedent or government regulations and the like. Is that correct, Greg?
Yes, thank you. Yeah.
Just to clarify for listeners who may not be understanding what we mean
right.
by legal authority in that regard. And this is something that attorneys do ad nauseum, but appropriately in formal legal writing, legal articles and legal journals will often have every sentence or every two sentences with a citation. They're referring to some legal precedent or other legal authority to support their assertion or proposition. And this is so to refer to something as a fact sheet, you know, in isolation and quarantine, as this document does, and yet to refer to no legal authority within it is a little scary. We presume they're basing this on legal authority, but we can't really tell. The Congressional Research Service has, which is a group of attorneys who research legal issues for Congress, has written on this topic, and they may very well have, and they, as good attorneys do, they cite legal authority throughout their documents. So there may be some other source of authority that we could compare to the fact sheet. That might be an interesting thing to do for another show, actually, Greg, to compare.
Just really quick, I'll speak to that.
Sure.
I did that. I reviewed the Congressional Research Service position on quarantine and isolation, written by Kathleen Swendeman. And she misstates what a quarantine and what an isolation is. And then, as part of her citation, she refers to a Homeland Security Council implementation plan. That's not even a law. You know?
Homeland Security what? Isolation plan?
It's like, who's fact-checking this? Is it me here in my office in Copperopolis? You know?
Well, maybe nobody.
I'm laughing,
oh,
but I'm laughing with...
That's what I'm trying to say. Maybe nobody.
These are chuckles of terror in my laugh here, because the idea that there's this potential level of arbitrariness in self-appointed rules by our government is more than a little disconcerting.
Well, if you print it up and say it's a fact sheet, it sounds very, very authentic. So that's all they need to do. How about we're going to end the show now. And, Alan, did you have any last words for the listeners and what we're going to be talking about next Thursday? Even though today is Tuesday, I'm just reminding everybody we had to do the show early. And we did also want to let people know about your ebook that provides information for those who are investigating for themselves and their family regarding exemptions and waiver rights in the United States, because people in every situation will need to make an informed decision. And this ebook will help you get through the vaccine exemption maze or determine whether you can do it on your own or you need an attorney to be your advocate.
And yes, and that's available on Homeopathy World Community. .com. So encourage people to do that. I would like to just very briefly but very sincerely offer my apology, Debbie, to you and Greg and listeners for my late arrival at today's show. I got absorbed in a rush project, research project, and that had to get out today. But very glad that I was able to join you at the last segment
right.
here. And Greg, as always, love the refreshing insights that you bring to and that extend well beyond my own areas and levels of expertise. So I always learned something and did again even in the short time that I was here today. So always appreciate having you and look forward to having you back again as always.
Thank you. That's very nice.
Thank you, Greg. Thank you, Alan. Until the next time. Bye-bye, everyone.
Take care.
Thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Bruck on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate before you vaccinate.
Let your truth be unfurled.